for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما صدق الله.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Russia invites experts from the United Nations and the Red Cross to probe a recent attack on a jail in eastern Ukraine that killed dozens of Ukrainian prisoners of war. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is determined to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement in talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. And the Iraqi prime minister calls for dialogue and calm after supporters of cleric Muqtada Assad occupied parliament in a deepening political crisis. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Moscow has invited experts from the United Nations and the Red Cross to probe the deaths of dozens of Ukrainian prisoners in a jail in eastern Ukraine held by pro-Russia forces. In a statement, the defense ministry said it favored an objective investigation into an attack on the prison earlier in the week. The facility in the frontline town of Olenivka, Donetsk province, was hit on Friday. Pro-Russia forces in Donetsk say 53 Ukrainian prisoners of war were killed and dozens more wounded in the strike. Moscow accuses Kiev of attacking the prison with U.S.-made rockets to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. Ukraine, however, denies any involvement. It says Russia conducted the raid to put the blame on Kiev. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he has ordered the mandatory evacuation of people from the eastern Donetsk region.
The government decision on mandatory evacuation from the Donetsk region is in place. Everything is being organized. Full support, full assistance, both logistical and compensation. All we need is a decision from the people themselves, who have not yet made it for themselves.
In a televised speech, Zelensky said thousands of people, including children, are still in the battleground areas of Donetsk, adding his government will compensate those who leave the region. Donetsk has been the scene of fierce clashes between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian military in recent days. On Saturday, the warring sides traded blame over an attack that allegedly killed dozens of prisoners in a front line held by forces loyal to Russia. Moscow says Ukraine hit the prison with U.S.-made rockets. But Kiev denies the claim and says Russia itself targeted the prison. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is determined to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement in talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks during a phone call with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani. The top Qatari diplomat also called for the continuation of the talks between Iran and other signatories to the JCPOA until the two sides reach an agreement. Tehran says revival of the 2015 nuclear agreement hinges on Washington's political will to provide guarantees that Iran can reap full benefits it is entitled to under the accord. Masoud Shajari, the head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position and actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit for tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
Iraq remains gripped by political uncertainty as supporters of Shia cleric Muqtada Sadr continue to occupy the parliament building for a second day. This is the second time that protesters have stormed the building in a week amid a deadlock over the formation of a new government. Sadr's movement says the sit-in will continue until further notice. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Al-Halbousi says all parliamentary meetings have been suspended. According to the health ministry, at least 100 protesters and 25 security personnel have been injured in the clashes. The demonstrators are opposed to the nomination of former minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani to replace Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The premier has urged talks to resolve the crisis.
The political blocs must sit down and negotiate and understand for the sake of Iraq and the Iraqi people. And the language of treason and exclusion must be avoided. I call on everyone to become patient and rational and not to be drawn into confrontation. And I call on citizens not to clash with the security forces and to respect the state institutions.
Iraqi political parties have also reacted to the storming of parliament. The Fatah Alliance called for dialogue to resolve differences among political parties. The head of the National Wisdom Movement made a similar demand. Ammar al-Hakim said political blocs should hold negotiations on the basis of preserving Iraq's national interests to tackle current problems. The bloc led by Sadr won most of the seats in the October 2021 parliamentary elections. However, the cleric asked all the bloc's MPs to resign last month after he failed to reach the two-thirds majority needed to pick a president to form a government. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas believes the ongoing political crisis in Iraq stems from the U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Have a listen.
Iraq has been in this kind of quagmire politically for as long as we can remember, certainly since the invasion of the Americans, and it's partly a constructed quagmire because the Americans didn't really create a plan where there was going to be genuine democracy. They didn't create governments or back governments which could really implement the kind of economic and political changes that were required. They didn't really enact any kind of efforts to eradicate corruption. Rather, they accelerated all this. So I put most of the blame of the current Iraqi predicament at the doors of the invading and occupying Anglo-American forces in that region. Well, the Anglo-Zionist American forces, I should say. As far as Muqtada Sadr goes, look, there are obviously these competing powers. The Americans have their own stooges, they have their own puppets and front men. The Kurds are involved in that, and many other tribal aspects in Iraq. So they back their own particular individuals. So The Iraqi people themselves go for anybody ultimately who is going to say, we're going to support Iraq and we're going to save Iraq from the talons of foreign powers, in particular the Americans.
Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to discuss the consequences of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen. During the conference, it accused the United Nations of ignoring Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdullatif Al-Washili reports from Sana'a.
Under the title Blockade on Yemen, Slow Killing of Civilians under the UN Cover, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in Yemen's capital Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the ongoing Saudi blockade on Yemen despite the UN brokered truce.
The United Nations participates directly and indirectly in the killing of the Yemeni people by its silence on the crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. Saudi Arabia is violating the terms of the UN armistice, and unfortunately, the international body has not taken any action. And there are falsification of facts and allegations that the Saudi-led coalition cares about the humanitarian situation in Yemen, and this is not true.
Officials say the United Nations is responsible for the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Yemen throughout the armistice, as it has failed to force Riyadh to fulfill its obligations under the agreement.
The United Nations is the one who monitors and inspects all ships, including food, medicine, and oil ships, but it does not inspect Saudi ships that carry weapons, and all Yemeni ships are prevented from reaching the Hodeidah port. We believe that the United Nations is responsible for what happens to civilians in Yemen because of its inability to force Riyadh to abide by the terms of the armistice brokered by the international body.
Recently, Yemenis have demonstrated in front of the United Nations Envoy's office in Sana'a to criticize Riyadh's continued detention of Yemeni fuel ships amid the UN brokered truce.
Human rights activists believe the Saudi violations of the UN brokered truce will not stop unless the world body takes real measures against the kingdom. They say the terms of the armistice should be completely fulfilled before any extension. Abdullatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Official data show that U.S. economy shrank for two quarters in a row. That signals the unofficial start of a recession there, an issue denied by President Joe Biden and White House officials. They cite positive facts, including a low unemployment rate, but that alone is not enough to push economic growth. The Federal Reserve has already raised interest rates four times this year to control inflation, which is at a 40-year high.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact, they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession.
It's the lunar month of Muharram. Muslims in Indian-controlled Kashmir have begun preparations to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. Banners and billboards with Imam Hussein's messages have been put up in different parts of the region. Sayyid Ali Safi has more in the following report.
Muharram, the first month of the Islamic calendar, is round the corner. Like in other parts of the world, people here in Kashmir, the only Muslim-majority region in India, are also gearing up for annual Muharram ceremonies. Roads and streets are draped with black flags and banners in remembrance of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his faithful companions who were massacred in the desert plains of Karbala in 680 AD. Painter and calligrapher Shaukat Ahmad is busy these days, preparing banners to be used in mourning rituals. The banners are in huge demand, as they are the integral part of Muharram ceremonies here. The Imam Bargahs, which are congregation halls for Shia commemoration ceremonies, are also being covered with black sheets and banners. The main Muharram commemorations are held in Imam Bargahs, where Kashmiri Marsiyas elegiac poems written to commemorate Imam Hussein and his companions are recited. Also, scholars deliver sermons to highlight the significance of Ashura uprising. Ashura is the 10th day of Muharram when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq 14 centuries ago.
While mourning ceremonies are held in different areas with sizable Shia population, the two major processions in the capital city Srinagar on 8th of Muharram and its 10th day, known as Ashura, were banned in 1990. Despite repeated pleas by religious and political bodies to lift the ban, the authorities remain unmoved.
Muharram processions will be allowed only on the already permitted routes. All those concerned have also been requested to hold processions through those routes only.
The authorities claim the traditional processions in Srinagar pose security threats. The religious bodies and civil activists, on the other hand, term the ban as, quote, blatant breach of religious freedom.
These processions were a symbol of unity, as thousands of Sunnis would participate with Shias in these processions. On the one hand, authorities say that the situation in Kashmir has been back to normal, but on the other hand, they are not allowing such religious processions to take place under the pretext that they would create law and order problems.
The state provides security to Amarnath Yatra that attracts tens of thousands of Hindu pilgrims. And on the other hand, it curbs the historic Muharram processions as well as the celebrations to mark Eid-u-Milad, the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad, in the city center. This speaks volumes about the gross discrimination against the Muslim majority population here.
Every year, despite the clampdown in the region, mourners defy the restrictions and try to carry out the Muharram processions, but they are tear-gassed, cane-charged and detained. With around 1.5 million population, Shias constitute 10% of the total population of India's only Muslim-majority region, which lies at the heart of more than 70 years of hostility between India and Pakistan. Sayyid Ali Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Mourning for Hussein across history. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As the Islamic month of Muharram arrives, mourning ceremonies and gatherings are held across the Islamic countries and other countries where Muslim communities live. Nearly 14 centuries have passed since martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, but every year, mourning ceremonies are held more fervently than the previous year. Let us have a brief look at the history of mourning ceremonies for the Master of Martyrs, the younger grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Hind was one of the beautiful and pious girls of her time. Her father, Abdullah ibn Amr, was one of the companions of Imam Ali and was martyred in one of the battles, and spent for long in Imam Ali's house, but later married to Yazid, son of Muawiyah. Thus, she resided in Damascus. After Ashura, which ended with the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his companions, the caravan of captives was brought to Damascus and settled in a ruined place near the palace of Yazid. The people of Syria were quite unaware of the martyrdom of the prophet's grandson, and due to ceaseless propaganda of their ruling system, thought that a group of rebels had been killed in war against the caliph. Therefore, they were rejoicing. In the heat of the merrymaking, one of the maidservants of Hind came up to her, saying, "Would you like to see a caravan of captives who has arrived in our city?" Hind accepted, but came across Yazid while leaving the palace. She told him of her decision and saw that Yazid's face was changed. He knew that Hind had lived in Imam Ali's house and knew his daughter, Lady Zaynab, peace upon her. Thus, Yazid tried to dissuade her but failed. Therefore, he told her that she could see the captives at night and accepted the condition. You will hear the rest of the story after the music. After the sunset, Hind came to the place of captives with her maidservants. She had been told that the caravan is led by a woman, so she went close to Lady Zaynab and asked her, "Where are you from?" Lady Zaynab answered, "Medina." Hind couldn't control her joy of hearing the name of Medina. Thus, she continued, "Really? If you are from Medina, you should know Zaynab, the daughter of Fatima, peace upon her. She was my teacher for a while, and I, whatever I know of religion, I have learned from her." Zaynab, who had recognized Hind in the very beginning, said, "Yes, I know Hind, the daughter of Abdullah ibn Amr. She is sitting in front of you." Hind was shocked with these words, and while she had removed her headscarf, she started moaning sadly. Then she turned into her maidservants. "Woe upon us! The captives are the Ahlul Bayt of God's messenger." Then she entered Yazid's place and cried out, "Is it you who had ordered to put Hussein's head on lance? Should the head of Fatima's son be hanging at my house?" Yazid stood up from his throne and, while trying to cover her head, told her embarrassingly, "O Hind, cry for the son of the daughter of God's messenger, since Ibn Ziyad, the ruler of Kufa, made haste in his affair. May God kill him. I was not satisfied with the killing of Hussein." Hind said angrily, "O Yazid, what's wrong with you that you are trying to cover my head while you are indifferent toward the daughter of God's messenger? You have torn apart their veils and shown their faces while settling them at a ruined place. By God, I will not enter your house unless I bring them inside with myself." Thus, Yazid was forced to let the captivated womenfolk to enter Hind's house. Then the women of Yazid's palace put away their ornaments and jewelries and mourned for Imam Hussein for 3 days. hearing the disasters of Karbala from Lady Zainab would make the women in Damascus weep sadly for Hussein, peace upon him. They were the very women who had welcomed the caravan with stones and reproaches. History tells us that mourning ceremonies were held for 3 days in Damascus, and the people of the city were ashamed of their behavior toward the progeny of the Prophet. The fiery speeches of Lady Zainab and Imam Sajjad, peace upon them, made them understand realities. Therefore, Yazid was forced to order the return of the caravan of captives to Medina in full respect. Yazid, in order to demonstrate his hollow awe, ordered the camels to be adorned with trappings. But as soon as seeing the decorated howdahs, Zainab said, "Remove all adornments and cover the camels in black." The people of Damascus ashamedly helped Lady Zainab and children mount the camels. The caravan reached Medina after a while, but resided outside the city for a few days. The people of Medina came to them and started mourning. Then the caravan entered the city and mourned beside Baqi Cemetery and the shrine of the Prophet. After the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, all imams would hold mourning ceremonies for him and would persuade their followers to mourn and cry for Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Mourning ceremonies in Iran were shaped broadly during the rule of Buwayhid dynasty in 9th century AD. In 964 AD, Mu'izzuddin Deylami made it an official edict to hold mourning for Imam Hussein and closing bazaars. On the day of Ashura, Hanafi clergymen would mourn and cry for Hussein while cursing the killers of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Seljuk rulers, too, loved Shia imams. Malik Shah in 1086 went to Najaf, Karbala and Qazamain for pilgrimage of the shrines of the infallible imams there. Mourning for Imam Hussein and the martyrs of Karbala was broadly common in Baghdad and other cities of Iran in the early years of Toghrul, the Seljuk king's rule. Taziyeh has been another kind of ceremony in Iran to mourn for Imam Hussein and the martyrs of Karbala. It is a tragic show in which the events of the great epic of Ashura are dramatized before the audience while the audience sheds tears. During the reign of the Mongol ruler, Olcay II, Sultan Muhammad Khodabande, Islam and Shia school was proclaimed as the official religion of the country. Thus, mourning gatherings and ceremonies were held quiet freely. This culminated during the rule of Safavid dynasty some 5 centuries ago. At that time, versifying poems in praise of the Prophet and his progeny, particularly Imam Hussein, peace upon him, was considered as a great honor. These poems would add to the splendor of mourning ceremonies every year. These ceremonies continued till Pahlavi rule. The first Pahlavi ruler, Reza Khan, in 1935 officially ordered the prohibition of holding mourning gatherings and ceremonies. Gradually, circumstances were tough for the faithful and religious groups as they would be detained and imprisoned. Yet people didn't forget their imam and the greatest sacrifice that he had done in the way of God and revival of religion.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The story of Masoud and Saddam.
Part 1.
Camp Ashraf, where the Mujahideen Khalq organization was located. Before finding a place in Iraq, this terrorist organization had taken thousands of innocent lives in the years between 1979 and 1981. Besides killing innocent civilians, the organization had other skills as well, planting tens of bombs, hijacking two airliners, and spying for the Soviet Union. All those are on this terrorist organization's track record. During the entire 8 years when Iraq, under dictator Saddam Hussein, was fighting its eastern neighbor, Iran, Saddam Hussein was fully funded and supported by many Arab and Western states. But among all regional and international supporters, one man was quite different. Masoud Rajavi, the leader of the Mujahideen Khalq organization, a terrorist cell. The organization's track record of crime and murder made it a trustworthy partner to Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. In the year 1981, when Saddam Hussein was on the crest of a wave and his soldiers still had some Iranian cities under their boots, Masoud Rajavi, along with Abdul Hassan Bani Sadr, then Iran's impeached president, secretly flew from Tehran to Air France. As they fled the country, Iran began to succeed in a series of operations in the war. In less than 2 years, the Iraqi dictator called for help in order to avoid a humiliating defeat. The relationship between Masoud Rajavi and Saddam Hussein began since then. June 9, 1983. Tariq Aziz, Iraqi foreign minister at the time, met Bani Sadr secretly in Paris. The main purpose was not to meet Bani Sadr, but Masoud Rajavi. In that meeting, Tariq Aziz had a message for Rajavi. Iraq was willing to acknowledge him as Iran's prime minister or president. The message carried many connotations. 3 years later, the world began to see Rajavi's true colors as the leader of a terrorist organization. The crimes committed by the MKO were so heinous that even the French authorities could no longer stand Rajavi or his organization in their country. They put Rajavi under pressure to leave France at the very earliest, finding no country in the world to welcome him and his group. Rajavi found the solution in moving to Iraq. On June 7, 1986, Rajavi left French soil for Baghdad, where he was warmly received as a special guest. Among all those ceremonial meetings with high-ranking officials, the most important was with Saddam Hussein, the godfather of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party, where Rajavi handed in a report on all his terrorist activities inside Iran. The purpose was to win the Iraqi dictator's trust. At the end of the meeting, Saddam Hussein gave Rajavi a generous gift, a gift to show how much the godfather liked him to join the ruling system in Iraq. The gift was nothing but a large plot of land in northeast Baghdad, in Diyala Governorate, for building a city called Ashraf. Attached to the gift were 50 tactical bases across Iraq from Alfa, a small port in the south of Kirkuk, a city in the north. Rajavi apparently had at his disposal whatever he needed. Building the camp that came to be known as the City of Ashraf, arming Rajavi's group, and paying them regularly cost Saddam Hussein millions of dollars. Rajavi and his group were expected to return this big favor by spying for Saddam Hussein's army in the war against Iran. The organization's willingness to spy for the Ba'ath army pleased Saddam Hussein so much that he decided to increase the budget allocated to the group and allowed Rajavi's army to act independent of the Ba'ath army. In the 19th of June, 1987, Rajavi announced the establishment of his army. He called his army the Free Army. He urged all his fans across the world to join this newly established army. All MKO headquarters throughout Iraq moved to Camp Ashraf. The organization brought all its activities into this place. The RAND Corporation is a non-profit that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. Commissioned by the Pentagon, the institution conducted major research on the conducts of the MKO, giving a detailed account of the bond between Saddam Hussein and Masoud Rajavi. One chapter of this report is on Saddam Hussein's full support for the MKO. Jeremiah Gulka, a researcher in the RAND Corporation, touches on the organization's money laundering in an interview with Al Jazeera English TV channel. The main point is that the money laundering was done in 2003, concurrent with the fall of Saddam Hussein.
First of all, that there was so much money, Jeremiah, that was being poured into this. Where does that money come from?
That's the big question, and that's what the Treasury Department's looking into. We've heard lots of rumors of Saddam Hussein having given them considerable amounts of money years ago. I don't know how good their investments were. I've heard rumors from members that I didn't necessarily trust. I knew know that when Mariam Rajavi was arrested in Paris in 2003, millions of dollars worth of investment vehicles were found where she was arrested. That's the big question.
Rajavi knew well that his godfather's generous help was not free, and that he and his group had to pay for them. A short time after the establishment of the so-called National Liberation Army of Iraq, it was used in the war against Iran. As native speakers of Farsi, members of this army could easily infiltrate Iran's military forces, gathering information on the front line for the Iraqi army. From April 1998 to July of the same year, the army carried out tens of small-scale military operations and two large-scale military operations, namely the Sun and the Chandelier, against the Iranian forces. Victory in some of these operations gave Rajavi and his organization such delusions of grandeur that when Iran accepted UN Security Council Resolution 598, which called for an immediate ceasefire, he decided to capture Iran's capital city. In fact, Rajavi launched his biggest military operation against Iran after the ceasefire. He called it Operation Eternal Light. In the early hours of the operation, the so-called National Liberation Army of Iran tried to wage psychological warfare by crossing the city of Mehran and reaching the city of Islamabad in Iran, a tactic employed by Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. As soon as the army reached the city's hospital, they beheaded all military forces hospitalized for their injuries and hanged 13 of them. The aim was to terrorize people and therefore nip in the bud any resistance on their way. But the operation didn't turn up to the expectation of Saddam Hussein and Rajavi. An ill fate was awaiting them. To Iran, Operation Eternal Light was not more than an ambush. An ambush set for the members of the so-called National Liberation Army of Iran. Many of the members were killed. With this bitter defeat in the last days of the war, the MKO became a heavy burden in Iraq for the Ba'ath regime. To remain in Iraq, Rajavi had no option but to be the official mercenary of Saddam Hussein, and that's what he opted for. And while signs of distrust began to appear among Iraqi military forces, Rajavi and his army played the role of cruel special forces for the Iraqi dictator. Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath party knew well that an organization that had shown no mercy to its compatriots was reliable enough to be more invested in. Saddam Hussein equipped his personal army with an array of modern tanks, personnel carriers, and even helicopters. The Ba'ath Party provided numerous military exercises for MKO members under the supervision of Iraqi seasoned commanders. Their military fitness was now a high priority for the Ba'ath Party. Meanwhile, Masoud Rajavi was looking for a bigger portion of the oil revenues. Up until the year 1988, on the track record of the MKO, was the assassinations of 17,000 Iranian civilians. But since the year 1991,
the Iraqi innocent citizens also fell victim to the organization's heinous crimes. Whereas Saddam Hussein's allies, whether in the region or in the West, stood against him, Masoud Rajavi and his armed-to-the-teeth organization stood beside the Iraqi dictator, throwing thousands of Iraqi citizens, including Kurds, into the jaws of death to nip in the bud the popular uprising of the Iraqi people.
In the limelight.
U.S. rate hikes are doing more to devastate Asian economies and currencies than tame U.S. inflation and overheating. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by William Pesek titled "Powell Pushing Asia into a New Financial Crisis." Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The mid-1990s vibe emanating from Federal Reserve headquarters in Washington is becoming harder for dollar bulls to dismiss. In the short run, the Fed's decision to hike interest rates on Wednesday, July 27th by 75 basis points, not a full percentage point, was greeted by investors as welcome news. However, what's not is how Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's past mistakes are about to wreck the second half of Asia's 2022. Powell is surely determined to make up lost ground, namely for sitting back in 2021 and calling U.S. inflation transitory instead of confronting it with sizable rate hikes back when it might have made a difference. Former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told CNBC, the question is, why did they delay that? Why did they delay their purpose? I think in retrospect, yes, it was a mistake. And I think they agree it was a mistake. Though coming now as consumer prices surge at a 9.1% pace, the 150 basis points worth of monetary breaking the Fed has done since June, the biggest move since mid-1990s, and more hikes on the way will do more to devastate Asia's next 6 months than tame U.S. overheating risks. Rising U.S. rates put China's giant export engine at risk. It complicates things for highly indebted mainland property developers struggling to avoid default. And then there is the nearly $1 trillion of state wealth parked in U.S. government debt. The yen's dwindling value, down 18% so far this year, is a crisis in slow motion for Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Bank of Japan Governor Hirokino Korda. Asia's number two economy is importing increasing waves of inflation via food and energy markets. The Thai bank is already down more than 10% against the dollar this year. In Manila, the new Ferdinando Marcos Jr. regime is struggling with the peso down 9.3%. As cost of food and other vital items surge, millions of Philippine families who escaped poverty over the last decade risk sliding back under the line. Both the Malaysian ringgit and Indian rupee are down nearly 7%, while the Indonesian rupiah has lost 5% of its value. The yuan is down more than 9.5% this year, causing its own headaches for the Bank of Korea. From Taiwan to Vietnam, powerful capital outflows into higher-yielding dollar investments are adding to pressures on Asian governments. As Asia braces for more to come, traders are buzzing about a reverse currency war whereby central banks favor stronger exchange rates to reduce imported inflation risks. Harvard University economist Jeffrey Frankel says it's easier said than done. Frankel says a fallout from runaway dollar strength, it is impossible for all countries to pursue such strategies because they cannot all move their exchange rates in the same direction at the same time. Ironically, the U.S. Congress on Wednesday, July 27th, hours after the Fed tightened, showed Powell a so-called better way to save the day. The Senate moved to deploy $52 billion in subsidies to semiconductor manufacturers and reinvigorate science and technology to raise productivity. Its broader $280 billion Chips and Science Act endeavors to boost competitiveness at a moment when China is investing trillions in owning the future of innovation. Many of the price pressures imperiling U.S. growth are coming from the supply side, from COVID-19 disruptions to surging commodity prices to Russia-Ukraine conflict to weak tech investment. The Fed, of course, has very little influence over steps by government and industry to increase economic efficiency. China is spending trillions of dollars to dominate the future of semiconductors. Biotechnology, 5G, electric vehicles, aviation, artificial intelligence, renewable energy, and green infrastructure. It's all a part of President Xi Jinping's Made in China 2025 scheme. In the meantime, Powell's Fed is now engaged in a 1990s-style battle with the ghost of bad decisions past. The worst, arguably, was Powell caving to politics in 2019 when his team began cutting interest rates when the U.S. least needed it. In August 2019, when Powell gave in to then-President Donald Trump, U.S. growth was buoyant, stocks were up, and the job market was sizzling. Trump, though, was enraged the Fed was raising rates on his watch. That rate hike cycle started in 2015 when Janet Yellen chaired the Fed. After meticulously ending post-Lehman crisis quantitative easing, the Yellen Fed in December 2015 boosted rates for the first time since 2006. Powell pushed on with normalizing U.S. rates after replacing Yellen in February 2018. Then the Fed got trumped. In speeches and tweets, Trump attacked Powell's rate hikes, even threatening to fire his hand-picked Fed chief. Powell acquiesced and began lowering rates. That U-turn had three negative consequences. One was adding liquidity the globe's biggest economy didn't need. Second, it wasted monetary ammunition the Fed couldn't use when the pandemic hit. Then there is the three. Number three, it did give damage to the perception of Fed independence. This latter problem makes today's echoes of the 1990s all the more relevant. The Fed's 1994 to 1995 tightening cycle under then-chairman Alan Greenspan greatly angered the Washington political establishment. His doubling of short-term rates in just 12 months caused great collateral damage in Mexico, on Wall Street, in municipalities around the U.S., and especially in Asia. The dollar's rally then as now put Asia at grave risk. By 1997, the strain on dollar pegs from Bangkok to Jakarta to Seoul became impossible to defend. A wave of devastations and devaluations set in motion the 1997 to 98 Asian financial crisis. Is history about to repeat itself? After two 75-tenth percentage point hikes in short succession, Powell's team seems to be setting the stage for a full 1 percentage point hike in the weeks ahead. Washington's fiscal position raises the stakes, with U.S. debt now